Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sangang Namami Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Sammasambuddho Vijacharana Sampano Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisa Dhamma Sarati Sata Deva Manu Sanang Buddha Bhagava Tamahang Bhagavantang Abhipujayami Tamahang Bhagavantang Sirasanamami Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sandhittiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachatang Veditabo Vinyuhi Tamahang Dhammang Abhipujayami Tamahang Dhammang Sirasanamami Supatipano Bhagavato Savaka Sango Ujjupatipano Bhagavato Savaka Sango Yaya Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichi Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yati Dancha Tavi Purisayugani Atta Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjalikaraniyo Anuttarang Punya Ketang Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sivasanamami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, or missing none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, upwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false use, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
So, here we have tonight's questions. And first question. Here we go. Hi, Ajahn. If your flame is extinguished and you are no more after death once enlightenment is achieved, why would one seek enlightenment? That's a very good question. Because if you seek enlightenment, you will never extinguish the flame. Someone's got a good understanding. Because the seeking, the wanting, that keeps you alive, but it also keeps you suffering. What is the second noble truth? Wanting is the cause of suffering. And what is the third noble truth? Letting go of wanting is the end of suffering. So when you stop seeking enlightenment or seeking birth, seeking anything, that's when you stop and the flame goes out. Do you understand? No, you don't. But, you know, you say these things, I'm not saying just out of fun and games, you understand, you don't, but just saying those things, the message gets in there and just later on, it just bears fruit. Is it okay to eat something before bed, as long as you go to bed in the morning time? Because here we're supposed to keep the 8 precepts if we possibly can. Then the 8th precept is not eating in the afternoon, evening. I used to eat small portions, so cannot eat a full bowl at once. I couldn't sleep all these days as I was hungry. If you've got like a medical condition, then that's fine. Then you can actually ask the manager, where's Leigh? Oh, has she gone? You tell me later. Oh, it's interesting. I can't wait. Oh. Ah, she's become enlightened, so the flame's gone out. Okay. Anyway, so just, you're taking over for the time being. So just ask Burr and say, no, because I really need this. And then just take something which is very small and simple. And that's not a problem at all. But if you do have some medical reasons, you've got to take some antibiotics or something in the evening, then that's fine, but you don't have a 3-course meal. You know, something simple, like a slice of bread or something, I don't know, something which is simple, but not eat a sort of a big meal. So, but all these things as I was hungry. You know, just eating just in the morning time, sometimes people say it's really, really good for your health. Just eating one meal a day in the morning time. And anyway, you know, I looked at history about, you know, people's eating habits. And eating many times a day is a very, very new sort of addition to human culture throughout the whole world. And if you look at, you know, in history, people would usually have maybe about 100 years ago only 2 meals a day. And they'd have like, they wouldn't even have a breakfast. They'd have maybe a lunch. And then they'd have something in the evening. And that was the main meal. And you go back early in history, you know, maybe 200, 300 years, and people would only eat a meal in the evening. In the morning time, lunchtime, they'd be working. And in the evening, they'd come together and have a meal with their family. So one meal a day, especially in the evening, has just been part of our human being culture for a long time. But if you go even earlier in history, you find that human beings only ate a meal whenever they could catch a dinosaur or a mammoth or something and eat it. So now the human body is actually quite okay with eating, not eating just 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times a day. It can handle it really well. So anyway, so you know, you try to do your best. But again, this is a compassionate retreat. So if you really, 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 really need to eat in the afternoon or evening, you can just go and ask the manager and just to get something simple. But anyway, there's all these other things you can eat in the afternoon. You know, you can have honey, you can have juices, you can have cheese, you can have chocolate, oh, so many other stuff. And I know one monastery, I never went there, thank goodness, but they, all these allowable things, which, you know, you can eat, a lot of them not really that healthy for you, but they started offering this chocolate ice cream in the evening. Where did that come from? And it was, you know, chocolate's okay, sugar's okay, but where did the cream come? It's not cream, it was Coffee Mate. They made ice cream with Coffee Mate. Where there's a will or defilements, you'd always find out some way of just, you know, pushing the envelope a lot. And that was pushing the envelope. I never had any. That's been really, really bad for your health. But nevertheless, they were to all these things which you could have in the evening for monks who've got too many defilements. So just keep it simple. And after a while, you find it's one of the reasons we don't eat in the afternoon or evening, it means the whole afternoon and evening, your tummy is free. And you get used to it pretty quickly. And when you get used to that, it means all that eating stuff and all the cooking and the cleaning afterwards, it's all finished. Now, how many of you were on sort of kitchen duty today? And if we had like an evening meal, that's twice as many of you will have to be on the duty, you know, to cook, and to, you know, eat and then clean afterwards. It takes up a lot of time. So just eating one meal a day is just so easy. And the rest of the day is free for you. So once you get used to it, it actually gives time. And when you do want to meditate in the afternoon and evening, you don't feel hungry. You get enough energy in your body already. And of course, when you meditate, you're not really using up much energy. And it means the whole evening you don't have to worry about all the blood going to your tummy to digest the food. It's all free. You can be in your brain or whatever to have nice, peaceful meditations. I've been doing this. I've been a monk over 46 years now, so I've been eating one meal a day for over 46 years. Look at me. If I ate two meals in the afternoon as well, evening, then I'd be in really big trouble. So anyway, but if there's a reason for it, and you're only on a retreat for 9 days, sure, just ask Burr. I have a confession. Oh, confession. We went to your cave yesterday, and I took its picture and shared with my friend. Now I feel guilty as I shared your privacy. Sorry. Oh, come on. That's not a trouble at all. I wasn't in the cave, so there's no problem at all. I'm sure that somewhere on the internet there's pictures of my cave. Because I wasn't in it, it doesn't really matter. No trouble at all. So what is really interesting, and this is something which comes up in interviews, sometimes people do an act like that, and it's no problem at all. But we think about it and make it into a problem because, oh, that must be wrong, I shouldn't have done that. Oh, what's going to happen? Oh, I'm going to go to hell in my next life. No, I might as well leave the retreat now because I'm never going to get deep meditation when I've done something like that. And some of the people think like that and they just make a small thing into a huge thing. And one of my stories for that is when I was meditating in Thailand as a young monk, and I've already mentioned there were some dangerous animals in that jungle. And just meditating there, just in my, I don't think I even had my mosquito net up, but just meditating in the jungle. After the first half an hour of dusk, then all the cicadas calmed down And it gets really peaceful in there. So they're sitting meditation in the forest, in the jungle, just nice and peaceful. And then I heard a sound. When you hear a sound in the jungle, it's pitch black, so there's no lights from anywhere. You've got a flashlight, but you don't want to keep using that. So I listened carefully and realized only a small animal, so no problem at all. So I carried on meditating. And as I was meditating, another 3 or 4 minutes, you could hear the sound of the animal again. It was coming closer towards me, and as it was coming closer, you could get a clearer picture, you know, from its sound it was making, of how big it was. And it wasn't a tiny animal, it was like a medium-sized one. It could have been like the old civet cats, which used to be around. There were mouse deer or something. So still it wasn't really dangerous. So I just closed my eyes and started meditating again. As it came closer, it made even more loud noise. And this wasn't a medium-sized, this was one of the big animals. And that's the point I got really scared. Because, you know, it could have been like a tiger or a bear. Bears were even more dangerous. And so I was afraid. So I got out my flashlight and I shone it in the forest, trying to find out where this animal was. You could, by the sound of, you know, just squashing the leaves and breaking the twigs, and it was a big animal, but I couldn't see it. And as I used the flashlight more, and then I finally saw it. A tiny mouse. And I told me, that's a bum, are you going crazy? But I wasn't going crazy, because what happens, once you get afraid, a tiny mouse feels like a big tiger. It sounds like it. And I was really surprised as how fear amplifies the sounds and images of things. So a lot of times, be very careful of, like, the fear. And that's what causes so much problem with people. It amplifies the danger, and it's not much of a danger there at all. So he didn't do a bad thing in that cave. It reminded me of another story somebody asked me to tell this the other day. This was a person went to got a friend, bought a new house in London. It was like one of these townhouses. But he got it really cheap. And the reason he bought it cheaply was the real estate agent told him that the previous owner had left because thought it was haunted. But like many people, he don't believe in ghosts. Ghosts don't harm you, so no problem at all. So he wasn't at all afraid. But he went there the first night, it's all cleaned up, and he slept there for the first night, downstairs. In the middle of the night, he was woken up. Rap, rap. Rap, rap. Someone was making a rapping sound. And of course, when these things happen, you open your eyes and is this real? And it was silence, and you thought it's just imagination. So he lay down again and he heard it a second time, rap, rap. So he got up and he turned the electric lights on and he checked all the downstairs. All the windows were locked, all the doors were closed, and there was no wind, there was no air conditioning to make some wind to make that noise. And he couldn't see any mice anywhere. There's no mouse holes there. So he was actually quite surprised in his imagination. Maybe because the estate agent said there was ghosts there, he'd imagined it. So he reconciled and he just went into bed again. And as soon as he closed his eyes, rap, rap, heard it again. But this time he realized it was coming from upstairs, the second story. So he had to find out what's going on. He wasn't really that afraid of ghosts, so he thought. When you're alone and you hear weird noises, it's amazing just how some rational people can be a bit afraid. So he went up to the second story and he turned on all the lights there, checked everything. Again, could find no cause for this sound, rap, rap. Rap, rap. So he thought he'd just go back to bed. But then as he was going down the stairs to where he had his bed, he heard it even louder this time. It was coming from the top story. these townhouses, they have many stories. So he went up to the top story, turned the light on there, checked everything. The real estate agent had left the house really clean and tidy. There's hardly anything there, just some furniture. And he couldn't find a reasonable cause for this weird noise. He really checked everything, and then he thought, it's just my imagination is playing tricks again. And he was about to go down for the last time to go to his bed. And he heard it loudest of all, coming from the attic. Attics are really strange, weird places. In all those books which I read as a kid, that's where you put crazy people. So he was a bit concerned, but he thought, I've got to find out. So he got a ladder, he got a flashlight, and he went into the attic, the little manholes they have there. When he went up into the attic space, just under the roof, that there was so much junk in there. The real estate agent had cleaned everything else out, but not the attic. There was so much junk there. And he was searching around for a ghost. What made this sound? And he looked everywhere, and he could, and then he heard it right behind him. Rap, rap! Rap, rap, really loud. And he turned around, and he shone the flashlight, and he saw it, the cause of the sound. It was an old piece of wrapping paper. Okay, you can both. So anyway, someone asked me to tell that story. Drachan Brahm, how do you make the present moment the pleasant moment? Thanks. You know, sometimes to appreciate just all the busyness which has been completed. Why, when you go on holiday, do you enjoy yourself? What is the enjoyment of holiday? A lot of it is because you don't have to clean up your room in the morning. The hotel does that. And it means you don't have all this busyness to do, like going to work and going through the traffic and getting the food. You know, the food is provided if you're on holiday. It's all the things you don't have to do gives you that happiness on the holiday. And it's the same, the happiness in the present moment. The absence of the past and the future. Wow. It's said that just, you know, if you can let go of the past, psychologists don't have a job. Because all that stuff of the past, the trauma, the difficulties and stuff, you let that go, that can't exist in the present moment. So straight away, it's just you're so free. And the future is easier to let go of because the future's uncertain. Hasn't happened yet. Which means that when you're in the present moment, all the fear and anxiety of what might happen next doesn't exist for you. All the fear and anxiety is what might happen next. The fear is looking at the future with a negative mind. Hope is looking at the future with a positive mind. So it's much better to be hopey than to be afraid. That's one of the reasons why someone told me that some people have put all these big signs in the US, it's quite a few years ago, don't worry, be happy, they said. I said, that's not the right way of saying it, don't worry, be happy. I said, change that to don't worry, be hopey. In other words, worry is looking at the future and all the things which might go wrong. Hopey is looking at the future and all the things which might go right. So being hopey is much better. So, and at the present moment, the pleasant moment, because you've got a positive state of mind. It's easy to stay in the present moment when it's a pleasant abiding. It's like freedom. Wouldn't you like to be free? No, don't have to worry about the past at all. Don't have to worry about the future. You've seen that little kids playing. They're so wonderful in the present moment. Sometimes they have a fight together. You know, since they'd had the fight, 2 minutes later they're playing like the best of friends. They never had a fight. Wouldn't that be wonderful? You know, if Mr. Trump and the Taliban and Mr. Biden and everybody else after the inauguration, they're just hugging one another, having a wonderful time. Why not? Why not is because they keep remembering the past. And they always say, this is the past, that's the past. That's the trouble with the past. No one knows exactly what happens and why it happens. And the other part about the past, that sometimes we think, oh, if I'd have done something else, if I hadn't turned left and turned right, if I'd have done something different, if. But you don't know what would have happened if you did something different. That's why there's a word in philosophy and religion which is called ineffable. You know, they say something like the truth is ineffable, God is ineffable, sort of love is ineffable. And I try to find out, what does that mean? Someone says it means you can't eff it. It's ineffable. But that didn't make much sense to me. So I changed that word to make it more useful. And the call of the past is ineffable, not effable. You can't if the past. You can't say if I, you know, hadn't become, if I hadn't come on this retreat, if I hadn't married that guy, if I hadn't had kids, if I hadn't sort of been lazy when I was at school, if I hadn't, what would have happened? You don't know. Could have been better, could have been worse, who knows? So the past cannot be ifed. And the present cannot be shoulded. I should be doing this, I should be doing that, I should do something else. Who told you? So when you take off the ifs and the shoulds and the musts, life becomes far more free and you're in the present moment. So, well, you know, if you don't have these shoulds and musts, then people will be misbehaving. You don't misbehave. I've got this incredible, not trust or hope, or I just, you know, human beings. Human beings are essentially good, kind. They only sort of misbehave because either they're thinking of the past, worrying too much about the future. In the present moment, you're naturally good and kind. Sometimes, you know, the nuns should know this, but you know, I've been a monk much longer than you've been a nun, any of you. Sometimes people ask me, all these rules you have to keep, aren't they a burden to you? Always have to remember what you're supposed to do, what you're not supposed to do. And quite honestly, it's not a burden at all. It's just natural. It's just, you know, even if I didn't know what those rules were, probably I'd keep them anyway, just because it's nice and simple and kind and peaceful. You know, what do you want to keep stuff for? It's much better. Those of you who've been in the caves, there's hardly anything there. It's much easier that way. So little by little, why argue with a person? Stupid. There was that, what was this? This was actually from a Mahayana story. There was an old master in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, and his student was going to go away for a while. So he asked his teacher, he said, please give me some advice, you know, because I'm going to leave you soon and go probably set up my own monasteries and stuff. Give me some advice. And the master said, never argue with an idiot. Don't argue with an idiot. And the student said, that's not kind. And the master said, yes, I agree with you. Okay, you got that one. So anyway, little by little, when you stay in the present moment, it's a wonderful place to be. And so I can tell a joke in the present moment. If you don't laugh, if it's a stupid joke, then afterwards I don't worry about it because it's in the past already. Present moment is a nice place to live. Of course, you have to do some plans and some memories, but not that much. Could you talk more about letting go of the things in the mind to leave only the breath, especially when the mind increasingly grows uncomfortable with a particular peaceful meditation? Actually, when the meditation gets very, very peaceful, it doesn't get uncomfortable with it. You get, Oh, first of all, I should say there's three stages of any new meditation state is recognition, familiarity, and then ease. It's the same when you have a new job. You know, you've got to recognize, you know, where your desk is, you know, who the people you work with are, and where you should go, where the toilets are, where to get a cup of tea if you need a cup of tea or coffee. It takes a while to recognize the situation, recognize the people, who to be kind to, who you can actually tell to help you. So, and after a few days, you recognize the place. And the next stage is you're really familiar with it. They're your friends. And the last stage is you're at ease with it. And that's the same, hopefully, for those of you who've never seen me before. You recognize me. That's just old Ajahn Brahm. And soon you get familiar. And familiarity is important to be a teacher. So in other words, that you can actually, you feel at ease. And, you know, that's the third stage. That you can actually say what's going on in your meditation, saying what's going on in your life. You're not afraid at all. And of course, the last stage of ease. So then, you know, you can share teachings together. But that's also important when you first go to your room, when you come to Jhana Grove. You've got to recognize where your room is. You know, where the hot water and cold water taps are. And just where everything is situated. And then you get familiar with your room. And probably even now, you're probably really familiar with your room. It's like your room now, your bed. And you're at ease there. That's your space. And you feel comfortable there. And you get a good night's sleep. First night, you never get a good night's sleep because it's a new situation. But anyway, when you get recognized, familiar, and at ease with the room, it's just the same with your meditation. You get a new state of meditation, and you just say only the breath is there and everything else has vanished. You've got to recognize what that is. That's good. And I spend a lot of time in interviews saying, yeah, what you did was wonderful. Well done. Because people have lots of doubts. Is this right? Should I have been doing something else? No, what you did was fantastic. Well done. And now you recognize, yeah, that was good. And soon you become familiar with those states. And then you can relax in them, become at ease with them, so they can stay much longer and even go deeper. So if you're getting peaceful, you feel uncomfortable with that state, it's because you don't recognize it. And maybe you're not familiar enough with it yet. You're not at ease with it. Peaceful states of mind. Enjoy it. Relax there. You don't need to be tense. So those are three states of every meditation. Recognition, familiarity, and ease. For recognition and familiarity, I try and help establish that by describing what they are and just saying they're very safe and they're wonderful. So carry on. And then you get to ease by yourself and then you're doing fine. Can you please explain the etiquette regarding doing walking meditations, yoga, tai chi, in the current context? Where and when is this appropriate? What about people sitting nearby? Should this also be considered? Yeah, that's why we have walking meditation rooms. So this is sitting room. That's walking room. This is sitting room. So don't go walking meditation in here or doing sitting meditation in the walking meditation rooms. Or doing sort of yoga in the toilet. But there's also other places you can do sort of walking meditation or sitting, such as in your room, or such as in the grounds, doing a walking meditation, sitting meditation. I can't resist all these real funny stories that when people do walking meditation, in some retreats, everyone has to wear the same clothing, usually white. Quite a few people here are wearing white. And they do this slow walking on purpose. See how slow you can walk. And I must admit, I was responsible for this once. I was doing walking meditation, not here, but in another place. And other people doing walking meditation at the same time. And I thought, who can be the slowest? So you're walking in the walking meditation and see if you can be slower than everybody else. And there's always one who's really, really slow. So it's really hard to be slower. What are you doing that for? It's absolutely ridiculous. Or a similar thing. Again, not in here, just, I think, where was this? In the old North Perth retreat center. Sometimes I made a resolution, young, stupid monk, and was, I'm going to make sure I'm going to be the last person to leave the hall in the evening, every evening. I'll be meditating there and be the last one out because I'm a monk. And what happened is, you know, just after the chanting and the talk or whatever, then people do a bit more meditation. I'll be sitting there half an hour later, I'll open just one eye. See who was left. There's always the same two or three people. Just who do they think they are? So, you know, I was really tired, wanting to go to bed, but okay, close your eyes. And then after another quarter of an hour, open one eye and see who's left. Another one person had left. Thank goodness, only two people left. Come on. And then what does it really matter being the last person there? Or not? That's total ego and stupidity. But anyway, it was in some traditions they just like doing the slow walking meditation. So they were doing it outside, not using a horse, you know, in the jhana grove. And it did happen on that day. There's a whole lot of them doing slow walking at the same time outside. And it was a Sri Lankan family. They're visiting Bodhinyana Monastery over the road. And I was talking to them. I said, oh, we'd really like to have a look at your retreat centre. Is it okay? And I said, well, there's a retreat on. So, you know, don't go close to the retreatants and be really quiet so you don't disturb them. And you can go and have a look. So they came here and had a look. And about 20 minutes later, they came back to me. And the kid, maybe about 8 or 9 years of age, was really excited. He said, he has to speak to you. I said, what's wrong there? What's happened at the retreat centre? Is everything okay? He said, no, it's not okay over there. It's like an emergency. What's happened? Your retreat centre, he said, has been invaded by zombies. And that's what he said. Could you imagine for a kid, people doing slow walking meditation? And apparently that's what zombies do. So to this day we call that zombie meditation. I should get on with the questions instead of making too much jokes about these things. What was the question anyway? Where's it gone? Yeah. So, and if you want to do Tai Chi or yoga, that's fine too, but sometimes to do Tai Chi or yoga, if you can do it in your room, that's really nice, because, you know, you can do whatever you want in your room and no one sees you. Or do it in a place which is, you know, not used by other people. So don't do Tai Chi or yoga in here, because, you know, that might disturb other people. Best is, there's many places you can find, nice quiet places to do Tai Chi or yoga. And that'd be wonderful. Dear Ajahn, how do I stop the commentary about my meditation? Thank you. Commentary is really interesting because, I don't know, there's a few Sri Lankans here, you may have watched cricket. And suppose, actually it's happening now, I found this out, I think I told you yesterday, no, I don't think I did tell you, that the Sri Lankan team is playing the English over in Sri Lanka, a cricket match. And I happened to see the news and the Sri Lankan team were doing terribly. So when the Sri Lankans visited, I think that was on Sunday, or could have been Saturday, I forget now. But then the Sri Lankans were talking about it, and so I said, oh, can I do some chanting for them? And it actually worked. I checked out, and the Sri Lankan team did much better the next day. You see, chanting is really good. But the reason I tell stories like that is because if I remember just as a kid, just watching, say, a football match or a cricket match, and if the commentator is like Sri Lankan TV, then the English are sort of cheating, or just, you know, they're not sort of, that was really out, and they said it was in. It's not fair. And if you look at the Sri Lankan commentary and you compare it with the English commentary, you think it's a totally different game. You know, you look at that in Australian football or tennis, and the commentary is not describing what's happening at all. It's always biased commentary. And you can see that when you have many channels, you can see a sort of a different country commenting on the same match. What about your meditation when you're commentating? Are you really being fair? You're not, it's biased, your commentary. And so when you know it's biased, and the weird thing is, for most people, the bias is negative towards you. And that's always really strange. If you're commenting on your nation's sports team, it's always a positive bias. But commenting on yourself is always negative. This can't be a limiter. This just can't be, you know, meditation. I just can't do it. And a lot of time, that commentary is false. You can do it. So first of all, don't trust that commentary. It's always biased. And number two, if you want to understand this, next time you do go home and you watch a movie, turn the sound off. Watch the movie without sound, without commentary. I remember doing this once. I was on a flight going somewhere, and many years ago, and those are the days when these little TV screens would fall down in front of you. You had no control over them. You couldn't sort of turn them on or turn them off. It just came right in front of me. And it was the in-flight movie. I didn't have any headphones, so I didn't know what the sound was, what the conversation was. But I saw the whole movie, and it was just one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. I was laughing my head off a lot of that movie. And the movie was called Armageddon. It was. I'm being totally honest to you. And people must have thought I was mad anyway, dressed in a robe on the flight. But it was just so hilarious. And I remember once saying, I'll never forget this, because you didn't have the sound and the music, nothing was playing with your emotions. You were seeing it just what was really happening. And I think they, as in the end of the world, usually, you know, it's the end of the world, and they always win in the end. They save the world. The very last moment, you know, it's going to be really to the second. Otherwise, it's not a real movie, is it? You can't sort of save it 5 minutes before. I think it was a meteor going to hit the Earth or something. And so they send up these two rockets or something to land on the meteor to blow it up or something. And one of those craft, you know, they lost control, obviously, and it hit this meteor really hard. It didn't sort of have no soft landing. There was sparks and flames and bangs and crashes all over the place for about a couple of minutes. If you were in the car and that stuff happened, you'd be obliterated. You'd be dead as dust. But that wasn't the end of it. After all these explosions and flames and sparks and electrical discharges and stuff, then this machine fell over this cliff about 100 foot, 200 feet, down this cliff, and then again, bang, crash, smash. Just, you know, all the pyrotechnics which, you know, Hollywood do. And it was, you know, just really visually quite sort of elaborate. And then it was quiet again. And then inside the spacecraft, a little hand came up. And then the hero pulled himself up, and that's why I totally lost it, burst out laughing. Because his hair was actually perfect. No sweat on him. No marks of carbon marks and soot marks from all the flames and stuff. He survived. And when he didn't have that commentary, you know, sort of trying to sort of grab your attention, it was just so hilarious. And I just burst out. People just, I think, if it wasn't an aircraft in midair, they'd have thrown me out. But the commentary and reality are just totally different. And it's experiences like that, turning off the sound when you're watching a movie. Try it out. And the movie looks so stupid. Turn off your commentary when you're meditating. There is a mute button inside, just experience rather than talk. And after a while you get so used to this, and you do this a lot. I often say, when you say watching a sports event or a movie, there's a commentary, but if you're watching to music, you don't. Because again, before I became a monk, I loved, I started off liking things like rock music when I was young, and eventually just turned on to classical music. Went to a classical concert. I didn't realize why it was really enjoyable until after I became a monk and looked back upon that. It was because I was never thinking. You couldn't have a commentary when you were listening to classical music. You couldn't describe it, because if you did, you'd lose the next chord which was being played by the orchestra. It captured your attention every second. And I realized for half an hour or 40 minutes, I wasn't thinking at all, listening to classical music. It was commentary free. There's so much else in my life which is commentary free. If you go for a walk in nature, it's very hard to have a commentary and actually notice the nature. Sometimes people can have a walk here in Jhana Grove and they can just write their autobiography. You know, they're thinking all the time, they're not really going for a walk. They don't realize where they're walking because they're thinking all the time. But if you really pay attention to the sound of the birds or the feeling in your feet or the wind in your face, then you can't give these things names. They're quiet, they're silent. So there's many examples when you're commentary free. See if you can notice those times when you're commentary free and how beautiful those times are. And that encourages you to be commentary free when you're meditating. You can't really. How many words can you use to describe your breath? In, out? What else can you say about it? Long, sort of long. After a while, you soon run out of words. I want, for a hypnotized session, wanted to know about my past life to a well-known hypnosis center, but it didn't work for me. I didn't recall anything. I felt like I was being asked to talk while in deep meditation, which was very hard for me. Can it be only done for certain people? Why was it not possible for me to recall my past life? Yeah, sometimes it's only possible for some people, but you know that when I was a member of the Psychic Research Society, and I couldn't be hypnotized. My friends tried to hypnotize me, and they said at the time only about 10 or 15% of people can be hypnotized. But that number has grown over the last 20, 30, 40 years because hypnosis has become more skillful. But it was, if you can't do it through hypnosis, see if you can do it through meditation. So when you do the nice deep meditation, and you're coming out, ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? And see what happens. If it's gonna happen, it happens almost immediately. Okay. As a monk, I'm not permitted to tell about my experiences of past lives or stuff like that. That's the eighth Pajitya rule for monks. So you can't give that information. Sometimes I tell people, I get very frustrated about that. But fortunately, because I learned the Vinaya really well, I know all the loopholes. And I don't mind using those loopholes because, you know, sometimes it's not putting myself up there as an important being, but it's like teaching these things can actually be done and how it works. So the loophole which I use, you've probably heard me say this before, the loophole that you can't tell about your previous lives, but you can tell early memories from this life. It's a bit of a loophole. Because it also describes sort of what happens. Because years ago, and I remember where this was happening, it was in the hall over in Bodhinyana, just doing some nice meditation, really, really deep, really peaceful. And then we were coming out of the meditation. That's where, I don't know where I got this from. Well, maybe I do now, but at the time, no. I didn't know. And it was just, I asked myself, what's my earliest memory? Very easy suggestion. What's my earliest memory? And immediately, I had my eyes closed in the hall. I was back in my baby's pram. It was maybe, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks old kid, baby. And you were back there. And it wasn't just like a memory, like you remember what you ate for lunch today. You were re-experiencing everything, like you'd been transported back in time. And you could you can explore your baby's pram. It was simple black and white pram, nothing, no colours in it at all. And a little, I can't even remember it now, a little string over the front. And on that string was one of my favourite toys, this little blue. I don't know if it was porcelain or plastic. And it had these little beans inside. You could actually shake it. And it was in the shape of a pig. And it was not very inventive. My mother called it Porky. So it was Porky the Pig, one of my favourite toys as a freshly born baby. And she would sometimes walk it and sometimes shake it. And you could explore everything. And one of the interesting parts of that experience, you know, you're back there in a pram, and you know, my rest of my body was you know, in Bodhinyana Hall. And I was a grown man. But then also recognizing my mother as a young woman by her smell. And that was really sort of weird, because I never expected stuff like that to come up. It was a smell. That's how I recognized her, because my sight was not that well developed yet. And her sound of her voice didn't really make much difference to me, but her smell was how I recognized her. And that was really weird. And that's how I recognized my pram, my familiar surroundings, by how it smelt. And it was so weird that, you know, when I came out of that and came back, you know, out of the meditation in that hall, I told a few people, because it was a real experience. And I think one of those people there was some medical scientist, and he said, "That's really fascinating what you just said." I didn't know this myself previously, that when a baby is born, that's one of the most prominent senses which develops first, the sense of smell. And those sight and sound develop later on in the brain. And most sort of doctors or people who know about the growth of children, they'll confirm that. But to me, it was just new understanding, new knowledge. And so those are the sorts of things to know. This actually works. Nice meditation, what's my earliest memory? And if it's going to happen, it happens immediately. Earliest memory, and straight away, your mind is just so well, you can't say disciplined, but so obedient. You do whatever you want. So this is how it's done. And of course, I've taught that to other people as well, here in Jhana Grove and other places I teach meditation. It doesn't work for everybody. It's much less people can do this and can get hypnotized. So hypnotized is a more likely way of remembering your past lives. But when you get it through meditation, it comes with this real strong sense of certainty. For years, I didn't know why that sense of certainty was there when I remember being in a baby's pram. And of course, it was, I don't know why I was so stupid not to understand that these are stages where the five hindrances have gone. And the last of those hindrances is doubt. There's no doubt at all, that was you. But anyway, one of these meditators, and again, I won't say her name, because, you know, that will give the game away. This is not a joke, this is a real story. When she was on a meditation retreat here, now she got an early life memory, and that was in the hands of her mother, breastfeeding. You know, only a few weeks old, a few days old, she didn't really know. But the problem was, when she looked up at her mum, her sight was obviously reasonably well developed, because the person who was breastfeeding her wasn't her mother, not the one she knew. And she came up to me afterwards in the interview time and said, "I'm really concerned. Because, you know, this is what happened. It was very clear that I was being breastfed by somebody that doesn't look like my mum at all." And she asked me, "Just, was I adopted? It says something my mother hasn't told me. Is that person my biological mother?" And you can imagine that was just quite traumatic for her. And I just told her, just, I don't know, but when you go home after the retreat, find a nice time, chat to your mum, and then ask her. And that's just what she did. And this was the result. The mother looked at her and said, what on earth are you talking about? Am I your mum? Of course I'm your mum. Well, why do you doubt that? And she said, is there something you haven't told me? It's okay, you know, that I still love you and care for you, but is there something you haven't told me? He said, no, I've told you everything. What are you saying? Why? When she said about the experience of in meditation, looking up at a lady who was breastfeeding her, and it wasn't anything like her mum, then her mum asked her, well, what did she look like? And because you have really strong memory in these states of meditation, especially the past life memories or early life memories, she remembered clearly the description of this person breastfeeding her. And her mother was just astounded. How on earth can you know that? Said, I was your mother, but I came from a wealthy family. We hired a wet nurse for you. And that's a really incredible, accurate description of the wet nurse we hired for you in your early days. There's extra information which you find out, it really convinces you this is not playing around, this is real. But if you do get into this, like some meditators do, they actually chided me because there's something I didn't say at the time, which I should have said, and I try and say it all the time now when I say this is possible. If you get back to your previous life, then often you get an experience, some of the closest experiences to this life, you know, in time, and some of the strongest experiences is what you remember so easily. And one of those experiences is your previous death. So quite a few people, when they say, what's my earliest memory, and they keep pushing it backwards, earlier than that, please, they get to their previous death, which is quite traumatic. I said, Ajahn Brahm, please don't ever tell people to do that again. It was really, because you're back there. You're experiencing all the sensations. It's not like looking from a distance, you're right in it. And they said, wow, I don't want to do that ever again. So if ever that does happen, the solution, I should have said this to everybody, just you're having an unpleasant experience, say, earlier, please. And then you just go back from that painful death moment to something a bit more pleasant. And your mind will do that straight away. Just give it instructions and it does it. So if you're having a difficult experience, then earlier, please. Or let's go back to this life. So it's fascinating what you can do. And you know what happens. And some of the information you get from this about previous lives. But it's also, for at last, you will understand that rebirth, reincarnation, previous life is a fact. You know, you experienced it, so you don't need to doubt anymore about this wonderful truth. And that has another wonderful effect on you. You understand that you don't have to worry too much about your relations who pass away. They haven't disappeared forever. And you don't have to worry too much about your own death. Death's come, death's go. It's one of the reasons why it's Buddhists are far, far, far more accurate talking about death than anybody else. The reason is because we've died many times. Christians only die once. That's only being jokey. Okay, I better get onto these questions. What is the purpose of walking meditation? What is the method of doing it? Apart from repeating, I will die, that's for sure. It's, first of all, in walking meditation, you can see it's learning how to be a zombie. That's just joking. In the halls over there, you start at one end, you go to the other end, and you come back again. You don't get anywhere. You end up where you started, like life. Like life, you start off with nappies, you end up with nappies. You start off not knowing anything, you end up having forgotten everything. Same. It's something like circular in life, and I love that idea of circles. Not getting anywhere, ending up where you started, going this round in these loops of life. But the most important thing is that sitting down, being calm and peaceful, your back aches, your legs ache, something aches eventually. So by doing the walking meditation, you can do some calm exercise to your body, just walking slowly, which means that it's much looser for your body. You don't get so tense and achy. But also, what do you do there? Again, put your attention about body length in front of you, not to look to the left or the right, keep your eyes open. You don't watch your breath during the walking meditation, you watch the sensations on your feet. You know, just like a simple thing. Don't look at your right arm now, but please, can you move your right arm up? Can you feel all those sensations? Now put it back down again. So many sensations, so many muscles have to move when your right arm goes up and goes down. When you're doing walking meditation, your right leg going up, moving forward and then going down. Those are the sensations you watch in walking meditation. And they become fascinating. I thought, first of all, it'd be so boring. But it just really gets into you, and there's so much going on. And the story I often tell, oh my goodness, is first year I was a monk. I was doing my walking meditation in this big hall in Bangkok. Maybe it was about this length, it was narrower. And it took me half an hour to get from one end to the other and half an hour back again. It wasn't because I was trying to be a zombie. It just was so much going on. You'd be feeling your feet moving up, and so many muscles had to be adjusted to walk. If you've known anyone, hopefully not yourself, who's had a stroke, to learn how to walk again is so complicated. And sometimes when people do that, they just, wow, now they understand little kids learning how to walk, just how difficult it is for them. But there's so many things have to be moved. You're taking it for granted now, but you're doing it with mindfulness now. And it's actually quite delightful to watch this. And on this one time, I often tell this story, I was really getting into my walking meditation, and I was just in my own little bubble world, and it was beautiful. And then from a long distance, my senses hadn't disappeared, but they were really weak at this time. I heard this sound from a great distance. Brahma Wang So. Brahma Wang So. It's like you're hearing from maybe a mile away or something. And then I stopped paying attention to my feet, paid attention to my ear, and realized there was a monk shouting in a loud voice right into my ear hole. And I realized why, because I was supposed to be at a function, at a dharana, and I'd forgotten all about it. And the abbot had sent this monk to come and get me. But he was wise enough to know it takes a bit of a while to get you out of a deep meditation, even though I was walking. Brahma Wang So, shouting in my ear. So, you had to turn to talk to him, to face him. And there's so many muscles you have to move in your neck to turn. It took me 2 or 3 minutes to turn to face him and then say, what? It's like a crazy monk. But it was just, that's what happens when you're in deep meditation. You're just so calm and so cool to actually to go up the gears and just be able to talk to somebody. It's really hard. That proved to me, though, just how peaceful and how much stillness you can get in the walking meditation. So please do a lot if you wish. If there is no soul, how one's previous life impact the later ones? Through what media? It is through, there's no soul, but there's a process. For example, the simile of the stream of consciousness. Why is that stream or that river in roughly the same place as it was yesterday? But over the years, the decades, the river moves. It floods. The current just wears away one bank, and sand or whatever is deposited in another bank, and the course actually moves over the years. But the basic course of the river, your karma, your character, just your inclinations, from one life to another, is not that different. Just like the course of a river. It can be changed, but that needs big floods of water going through, powerful surges to change it. That's a simile. And just the same, the stream of consciousness from one life to the next, one thing causing another thing, and the in-between lives. Now, sometimes call them ghosts, but they're not really hungry ghosts, they're just in-between lives, going up towards the light. Why do you go up towards that light? Why aren't you afraid? Because you've heard it from monks like me, not to be afraid. You understand exactly what it is. You let it happen. You know exactly what to do. Don't be afraid, don't be excited. Relax and let go. So the things I teach here, sometimes I call these types of talks like dying 101. So you actually learn how to die well next time. Dear Ajahn, even with metta meditation, can we achieve piti sukha? Oh, huge amounts of piti sukha with metta meditation. It's gorgeous. But you don't just have to do metta meditation. Again, years and years ago, any of you remember going on those retreats in the Penguin Road in Rockingham or Safety Bay, Safety Bay retreats? And those are weekend retreats over there we used to do years ago. And I remember going there just really tired one day. And what can I teach today? Can't tell the same old jokes. I just usually wait for a few years to tell the same old jokes. But then one day I thought I was really tired, and so why don't we do metta meditation and breath meditation together? So I started doing that, and that was just like dynamite. Just the breath was so easy to watch, and it was just with loving kindness. And I just had some great meditation. And I must admit, I never slept that well that night. Not because I was anxious, I was just too much energy. Beautiful piti sukha energy coming up. Well, that was an amazing night. But this is what you're doing. Just the loving kindness is incredibly powerful. And loving kindness can take you all the way to full enlightenment. So it's beautiful stuff. So loving kindness, as long as you just do it properly, you let it go. It's not you doing it. You let it happen. And nimittas, loving kindness, I don't know if it's for me and for others, usually get this beautiful golden nimitta. And I don't know why that's the case. The colour is usually that colour. Beautiful gold, gorgeous. And of course that really attracts you into the deep meditations of the jhanas. Really easy. Would it be possible for you to please explain the difference between yogic meditation, Buddhist meditation? Are they different paths up the same mountain? Yeah, it would be possible for me to explain that. That's not the question. Would it be possible to explain? Oh, you want me to explain it? Okay. Yeah, yogic meditation, because I haven't done yogic meditation, so I don't really know the answer to that. But I do know the answer that once the mind becomes still and energized, of course it's meditation is meditation. No religion owns it. Although it does seem to be, but I might be biased because I'm a Buddhist, that the Buddha explained it in the greatest detail and understood so much more of it than I've read in many other books. So, any difference? I don't know. Are the five material realms, etc., in other dimensions? No. The five material realms are just in the realm of the mind. So you can say the dimensions, like in Buddhism they have these three worlds, the Tiloka, Notice the first world is a world of what I call Karmaloka, the sense realms, which also includes the ghost realms and the heaven realms as well. But beyond those, you've got the Rupa Loka and Arupa Loka. The Rupa Loka are the jhana realms. So you're experiencing the peace and bliss of jhanas for huge amounts of time. And there's no body involved. Just like, say, to get in those deep meditation, you have to let go of the five senses and the body. This is actually where a person can get reborn. Wonderful time. And the arupa are even more refined. And the arupa means this, just concept. Concept like the nothingness. And that stays a long time. But the deeper you get there, when I say that, you know, do you understand? If you had maybe a few jhanas, then maybe you can understand that concept of things so disappearing. You can understand maybe what those immaterial realms are, but beforehand, they're just a bit too much. Dear Ajahn, can you paint a visual picture on how to inject compassion, kindness and non-controlling into the aversions of the mind? Aversions, even like dying. Straight away, that, you know, when you understand what dying is, of course, there's, you know, if you can't avoid it, then let it happen. Sometimes you just, I suppose, on this retreat, that we had prizes. And the first prize on this retreat, taken at random, you know, all your names in a box and pick out one at random, was like a holiday overseas. Now, forget about COVID and stuff. And maybe a holiday to Hollywood, Los Angeles, where you'd stay in a six-star hotel, not a five-star hotel, a six-star hotel, all paid for by the Buddhist Society of West Australia. Flying, not business class, but in a first class, for you and a friend, and having $1,000 each per day to spend, and dinner with your favorite Hollywood actors or actresses. Now, I don't know who your favorite actresses are, Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, I don't know. You know, personal breakfast with them, or lunch or dinner or whatever. And, you know, after 2 weeks, and then come back again, first class to Perth. Now suppose I picked out your name and said, Ananda Tilakasiri, you've won this prize. Well, actually, maybe you've been meditating too long, but maybe somebody else. And you think, wow, I'm going to go to Hollywood. All expensive, pay $1,000 a day each, meet my favorite movie stars or whatever. And then I say, in 7 days' time, you can leave. You get so excited, you'd be counting down the days, 7 days, 6 days to go, 5 days. The day before, you wouldn't be able to sleep that night. You're going on a trip of a lifetime the following day. And you think, can I go earlier, please? I can't wait. And then I say, which is more delightful, going to Los Angeles in the six-star hotel or going to some heaven realm? Well, the heaven realm is much nicer. That's not six star, that's billion star. And so, those of you who have been really good people, which is just about all of you, if the doctor said, Ananda, you're going to die in 6 days, if you really understood, you'd say, can you make it 3 days, please? I can't wait. I can't wait to go to a beautiful place. And that's adding some wisdom. You go to see the doctor, say you've only got sort of 6 days to live. Can you make it 1 day, please? Or that wonderful monk, Dr. K. Sridhamananda, he was the chief priest in Malaysia for many times, many of you may know him. When he was told, I checked this out with his doctor, it was true, that when he was told that his cancer was incurable, he's going to die in about a couple of weeks, he laughed. He laughed his head off. I thought it was so funny, so enjoyable. Did that happen? He said, oh, yeah. It's the only one he's ever done that. He was actually laugh when he says, only got 6 or 7 days to go, or a couple of weeks. Yay, I'm out of here. I can really retire. I can understand that now. There's no way I can retire until I'm in a box. So somebody comes up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, I'm terribly sorry. You're going to die in a week. At last, yes, 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 yes. You get really excited. Do you understand? That's adding wisdom to some of these negativities in your mind. The other time, if there's any difficulties, you got some sort of sickness, it's amazing, you can learn so much. Or any difficulties in your life you have to do. Because sometimes, as a monk, I know that I have to give lots and lots of talks for many, many more years yet. And so it's wonderful. If you have any difficulties or problems, you know, with whatever, it's wonderful. You get much more opportunity to teach, you know, from all of your experience and wisdom, which you don't just get by reading books. You get from life's experiences. So those are wonderful things. When things go wrong in life, yay! It is literally more dog shit from my garden. And you can always take some more. Okay, that's how to compassion, kindness and non-controlling into your versions of the mind. Okay, there's only 2 questions left. Of course, hopefully that some of you have come here for the first time, but every retreat I always talk about the monster in the Emperor's Palace. So that's actually a story told by the Buddha of how negative experiences in the mind, how they can be treated. And that story, I haven't told that yet, have I? Not this retreat. There was I like to change the gender every now and again. It's 2021. So the Empress, it was going to a Friday night talk at the Buddhist Society of West Australia. And while she was away, this big, smelly, aggressive, violent, scary demon, this monster came into her palace while she was away. And that some beings are just so scary that even the security around the palace, you know, the guards, the soldiers, they were terrified. So they, you know, they hid behind the flower pots, under the benches, anything. Just they didn't want to face this monster who was so scary. And that allowed the monster to go right into the throne room and sit on the Empress's chair. And that was going a bit too far, so the security realized they should have stopped the monster earlier. But once it was in the Empress's chair, they said, "Get out of here! Who do you think you are? This doesn't belong to you. Out now." And those few unkind words and threats, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive, more frightening. And so they made so many threats and to this monster, and it kept getting bigger and smellier and uglier. And by the time the Empress came back, this monster was huge. It was so frightening that usually in this story, I ask people, because I don't watch movies, what's the most frightening monster you've seen in a movie? And it's supposed to be alien? Is that correct? This made alien look like one of our teddy bears. This was really super scary. And was so smelly, the stench coming off this monster even made maggots throw up, according on his skin. But the Empress, the reason she was Empress was because she was smart. That's why she went to the Buddhist Society of West Australia on a Friday night. She knew exactly what to do. She looked at that incredibly frightening, scary monster and said the amazing words, "Welcome. Now the door of my heart's open to you, monster, no matter how violent, scary you are. Thank you for coming to visit me." And she meant it. She said, "Has anyone got you something to drink here? Do you want a cup of tea, some orange juice? You know, we've got lots of types of tea. You can have English tea with condensed milk, like Ajahn Brahm. Herbal tea, good for your health. What would you like?" And she really meant it. And of those few kind words and actions, that monster grew smaller and less offensive, less ugly, less frightening. And everybody realized their mistakes. So they started being kind to the monster. And about a dozen of the security men, they said, would you like a foot massage? Because the feet were so large, it took about a dozen just for the big toe. And they go, you had a foot massage? It's really nice. You get this really nice foot massage. The monster just over there, oh yeah, oh, that's nice. And every kind act, or kind thought, kind word, the monster kept on shrinking. Until the monster was so small, the same size as when he first came in. They kept on with the kindness. Until soon the monster was so tiny, that one more act of compassion, the monster vanished completely away. And that's in the Yaka Samyutta, in the Buddha's teachings. Of course, you know, I added a lot to it, but the basic story is there. They called it anger-eating monsters. And that's incredibly powerful psychology. So when you've got defilements inside your mind, remember they're like monsters come to visit you. May all beings be happy and well, even monsters. And then when you're kind to your defilements, the defilements, they shrink and they vanish. It's an amazing way of overcoming monsters in your mind. Could you please explain bowing? For example, why three times? How to properly do it? Thank you greatly. Okay, this story of my bowing story. Because that's something which in the West people ask, you know, why do you do that for? Is that just kowtowing? That's only a lump of iron. What are you doing this for? What's the purpose of bowing? And the answer to that was a story when I was invited to give a talk at Christchurch School over in the Cottesloe, not Cottesloe, it's in Mosman Park or somewhere. Claremont, okay. It's one of the top schools. It's got these incredible views over the Swan River. But anyway, because I knew the chaplain there, it was Frank Sheehan. He was a good mate. And so he said, why don't you come for the assembly to give the talk there? I said, yeah, sure, why not? So I had to go really early. And he was waiting for me and said, look, we wait outside the big sort of chapel or hall or whatever it is called. And once all the, at that time it was a boys only school, once all the boys had settled down, then myself, the chaplain, you, the speaker, and the principal will actually enter. And the principal said, yes, we know, welcome. But because this is a Christian school, Anglican school, and said, when we go in, the chaplain and I, the principal, we will bow to the statue of the Jesus. Had a statue of Jesus in there. But you're a Buddhist monk, you don't need to. And that I took my opportunity. And I turned to him, I said, Frank Sheehan knew me really well, I was playing around. And I said, Mr. Principal, I demand my right to bow to your statue of Jesus. When I said something like that, he was, what's going on? And then I said, yeah, I'm not a Christian, I'm a Buddhist. But there's something in that, I can always see something worthwhile in all beings. There's something in that which I can really respect, and that's what I'm going to bow down to. What in Christianity I respect. And he was really impressed. And so the three of us, we went in there, and I did a bow to the statue of Jesus. And then I gave the talk on that. I said, when I go to bow to a Buddha statue, I'm not bowing to a lump of brass. I'm bowing to what it means to me. And in particular, my first bow is always to virtue, to morality, to goodness, to sila. Because I've lived my life by trying to be as virtuous as possible, as good, as trustworthy as possible. You know, how I teach is how I live. And you've been to my bedroom, the cave, so you know how I live. And so, because of that, you've got to be trustworthy and real. And I value that so much that I can bow to it so easily. When I bow to it, I'm lowering my head and virtue is up here above me. Thank you, virtue, for making my life just so joyful and trustworthy. So I've got nothing to be afraid of. policeman visits, I'm not afraid of, what have I done? So I've done nothing. So it gives you this wonderful sense of peace and freedom when you practice virtue. So I bow to that so easily. And the next thing I bow to is peace, stillness, meditation. But not just the peace in your mind when you're meditating. The peace in the community. The peace in jhana growth here. When you trust one another, you don't argue with each other or beat each other up. It's a peaceful place. And when you have peace in your community, in your meditation, oh, that's just so inspiring. Peace. I bow to that so easily. In my own mind, in my practice, in the community, even in the world, I wish there was more peace. So I can bow to that. I worship peace. And the last thing I bow to, sometimes it's wisdom, but I must be honest with you, it's mostly compassion, kindness. Because when you see beautiful acts of kindness, people looking after one another, oh, that's just, that brings this shine, this burnish to the world. And the world looks so gorgeous. So I bow to kindness, compassion. Those are my three bows. When I bow to see the Buddha, that's what it represents to me. Virtue, peace and compassion. Or in the Pali, Sila Samadhi Panya. And the result of that, the principal was really, he was a devout Christian. He was so impressed that they organized a couple of coaches, buses, to bring whatever students wanted to have a look at Bodhinyana Monastery 2 weeks after my visit. And the principal came as well. The principal, really busy man. He wanted to see this for himself. So you know, I met them when they came on the bus, and the principal and I, we went into Bodhinyana Hall. And we both knelt in front of the big Buddha statue there. We both bowed three times to the Buddha statue. Or rather, we bowed to virtue, peace and compassion. And this principal had no problem at all doing three beautiful bows. The only thing was, I wish we could have taken a photograph or a video of doing that. Two different religious leaders, both bowing to a Buddha statue, because we understand what the bow meant. He's not saying you're a Buddhist. It's saying that you really worship, respect what it stands for, virtue, peace and compassion. I really enjoyed that. Anyway, last question. Thank you for all the incredible work you do. I was super interested in the talk last night and I'm wondering, at what age can you become a nun? These four amazing nuns don't look over 19. Is that true? Is it 19 or 90? No, they're really nice nuns. And yet they've also been nuns for years. Also, how long does it take? So actually, I said that tomorrow we're going to introduce one of the other nuns. Is it Pasana?
Katika.
Katika, okay. So that gift was for Katika, not Pasana. Did you get the gift? Yeah, in the bag. Yeah. No, it's supposed to be for Katika, I think, isn't it? You can share it. But anyway, so Katika, please. So, why did you become a nun?
Because it's awesome.
Awesome, yeah. What else? And are you 19? How old are you, nuns?
I'm 33.
33? And how old are you, Pasana?
39.
How old are you, Pasada? 45. And Padma?
31.
31, so that's their ages. So they're like women in the prime of life, I would say, those ages. There's so many things you could do in life at these ages. And most of the nuns, the monks, they've all got incredible good skills. They've got degrees all over the place. But they still, they would rather be a nun because it's awesome. So, anyway, Padma, you have to prepare tomorrow because that's what they're doing. And how long does it take to be a nun?
A year.
Yeah. I know at Dhammasaya. At Dhammasara, They do have a rule that you have to be under 50 before you ordain. Is that still the case? Yeah. But that's only because if too many elderly people ordain, then all the young nuns have to spend all the time looking after them. Which is, you know, I've seen that happen in other monasteries. It's happening a bit in the monks' monastery. There's quite a few elderly monks there. But, you know, they can actually walk up and down. They're pretty fit and healthy, so it's not a problem yet. But, you know, sometimes if you have, you know, a monastery and there's just about 5 or 6 elderly nuns and only 3 or 4 young nuns, that's where the monastery falls apart. But then again, you see some people that want to become nuns, and why not? Because they've just done so much service. That's why, who's the oldest nun at Dharamsala? Venerable Gotami. How old is she? 37? Say 37? No, she's really ancient. But if ever you see her, that, you know, she can walk and work and... Exactly. So if you're a person like that, of course, it doesn't matter about your age, but she just helped out. She was our secretary of our Buddhist Society, West Australia, for such a long time, would often give lots and lots of dana. It's only after her husband passed away that, you know, she really got into being a monastic. And just no hesitation for someone like that. You know, I personally would feel just almost like guilty if we didn't ordain somebody like that, because they've given so much service. So, yeah, it's supposed to be 50, but depends on what type of 50. So that's our online community. So hopefully you've enjoyed this tonight so far, and then we have great having nuns here as well as monks. Try very best. And, of course, in the later on, that we have more of the nuns teaching retreats. More of the nuns actually teaching an Olamara. Because many of you may know this year, because of COVID, that somebody had the idea of, you know, starting some streaming talks from here, from sitting here. And it's too much for just senior monks to do, so let's get some of the junior monks to do it. We have a rule in Bodhidharma Monastery, if it's your idea, you have to do it. So some idea of some junior monks, so they gave the talks as well. It's so impressive. Just some of the junior monks we have over in Bodhidharma give great talks. And so that was an eye-opener for me even. And so it's wonderful to be able to know that all the monks and the nuns who you support and feed, you're investing in the future of the Dhamma. And there come a time when they start giving talks. And you surprise yourselves. When you give a talk and people say, that was an inspiring talk. Say, no, not me. I'm just a young nun. There's something about having these brown robes on which makes a talk different. It's not just what you know. It's how you live. And that comes out in the talk. And that makes, wow, this is inspiring. And what it also does, all the people who listen to this, say, wow, that's what I want to be. Maybe not even in this life, but in a future life, to also be a nun, be a monk, and live this monastic life to its fullest, and lead the Dhamma in our world. So are you all proud of the nuns you've seen here? Really?
Yes.
They're great. Yes, that's wonderful. Can you accept that, nuns? Or you're thinking, they don't know really what I'm thinking about or how I live my life? No. Each nun, each monk has their own strengths and weaknesses. But when they accept those, it's amazing how inspiring it can be. I don't know why this always comes up, but I was just telling a few people in their interviews, there's a couple of monks who are clinical schizophrenics. Well, you can't allow them to be monks and teach. They go crazy. No, they're not. They're amazing monks. I don't know if there's any clinical schizophrenics amongst the nuns community, but it doesn't matter, because with some mindfulness and some kindness and some medication as well, medication and meditation, two together, you don't know. And then there's this wonderful life of inspiration and service. I think, wow, this Buddhism is brilliant. That instead of putting them in some sort of institution or thinking that they can't contribute to life, they contribute and they just blossom. And I don't say, I can't, well, not tell you who they are, because I promise not to. And you wouldn't be able to know it. You look at them and they're just brilliant, beautiful monks. And hopefully, I don't want to know, the nuns are beautiful nuns, inspiring and great leaders, and show what's really possible in this world. Don't define a person and stigmatize them. They're much greater than that. And when you allow that other part of a person, not just their faults, the other part of the person to really grow and blossom, you get some amazing examples. And I can't talk about schizophrenia because I've never experienced it. But these monks can. And how to deal with it positively. What a beautiful teaching that will be when they get old enough to give those teachings. Oh, something to really good to look forward to. So anyway, I better stop now because I've gone on over time, as usual. I inspire myself. So thank you for giving me the example. You give me the opportunity. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. And thanks for all those questions. And I do often apologize. If I didn't answer the question exactly, sometimes I don't understand exactly what you mean in the question, but please ask it again. I'll try my best.